KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's second Forum Hour, we'll talk with Bay Area writer and National Book Award winner Maxine Hong Kingston about her book, The Fifth Book of Peace, as well as a range of subjects, including war, peace, veterans, writing, East and West. She'll join us with your calls and emails right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to Forum. In October 1991, on the day of her father's funeral, Bay Area writer Maxine Hong Kingston's home burned down in the tragic and destructive Oakland Hills fire. The manuscript of her book, The Fourth Book of Peace, was destroyed in the conflagration, along with computer backups of that book. And 12 years later, out of the phoenix of the fire, she published The Fifth Book of Peace, a combination of memoir and fiction that included a recreation of the narrative destroyed in the fire. New book also included writing about teaching writing workshops and working with war veterans, as well as a how-to on world peace. And I ought to mention here that legend had it that there were three books of peace in ancient China with instructions on finding enduring peace that were said to have been destroyed by fire and have been prohibited with changes in regime. Maxine Hong Kingston won the National Book Circle Critics Award for Woman Warrior, which sold over 600,000 copies. Her book Chinamen won the National Book Award. She's also the author of Tripmaster Monkey and Hawaii One, and the recipient of the Penn West Award for Fiction, an American Academy of Arts and Letters Award in Literature, and the Ainsfield Wolf Race Relations Award. And in 1997, then-President Bill Clinton awarded her a National Humanities Medal. She is presently an emerita senior lecturer in creative writing at UC Berkeley and joins us this morning for our second hour. It's good to see you again. Welcome.
Well, good to see you too, Michael.
So let's talk about peace for a moment. I want to talk about the book and want to talk about what you're up to. A lot of gardening, I know, these days now that you're emerita. But the first book that you did, The Woman Warrior, is a book, of course, which so many people have read. We did a book hour on it, which you were kind enough to call in on our book club of the airwaves. And you were associated with this great myth of the warrior. Now you're a warrior for peace, I guess, aren't you?
Yeah. And I have been worried these last 25 years since The Woman Warrior that I wrote this book that is being used as a learning text at the United States Air Force Academy and at the Coast Guard Navy Academy. And I thought, why I don't want to make that my contribution. I actually asked the teacher who was using The Woman Warrior at the Air Force Academy, why are you using this? And he says, it's because there are women. Women are in the military, all branches of the military now. And so and the women cadets need an ethos and a mythos. And I thought, oh, no, I've got to give them a better ethos, mythos. And so I, in a way, have been rewriting The Woman Warrior. And I want to write peace stories that are as strong as the war stories.
It's one text, then, that keeps continuing. It's flowing in some ways.
All my work is one text.
But there was the sense in the Woman Warrior, I want to talk about the most recent book, but there was a sense in The Woman Warrior of a righteous indignation, of a fierce sense of passion, of righting wrongs and injustices, you know, including lopping off the head of someone who was essentially kind of a piggish character and a tyrant or despot. There was that sense of using words and using words in ways that would combat words that were racist words and that were sexist words and so forth. And that spirit of warrior is still part of you, isn't it? In a sense, now I'm not talking about the lopping off of the heads, but the passion or the fierceness against evil.
Well, the use of words to accomplish what swords and bombs and bullets could do. Trying to change military equipment into metaphors. Can words, can art be as powerful as military weapons? And that has been my passion, my work. Is it possible to find a language that can make peace in the world?
You're still phrasing it as a question, so you don't know if that is possible? Are you assuming it's possible? Or you have faith and hope that it's possible?
That is a question that I would keep asking myself, and I keep answering that question in my writing. Can I write peace stories? I tried to write peace stories that would be as dramatic as war stories.
Well, I think you've accomplished that to a degree in the new book. And I want to talk about the genesis of this book. I mentioned it somewhat in the introduction, but there were actually three books of peace, that, at least according not only to legend, but probably fact.
Probably. There must be, because it would be the human nature, the nature of artists to write a peace book that would balance out the art of war. You know, Sun Tzu's Art of War is alive. It's taught in military academies. There must be 100 translations. They're used in business schools.
Even Tony Soprano claims he read it, in fact, in the
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
I bet he did.
Again, a warrior book, really.
Yeah. And so surely there, the Chinese culture being this culture that appreciates yin and yang, somebody must have gone out there to write the complimentary book, a book of peace. On the other hand, being a peaceful creature is brand new in human evolution. Maybe those books are now being thought about. Maybe they weren't just written and destroyed, because the peaceful creature, the person that Martin Luther King Jr. Dreams about, the person that Gandhi taught us to be, we have barely begun to evolve that, and I'm talking about the language of peace. I'm just making it up. I'm trying to change the English language, the American language, so that we don't say things like, oh, we're fighting for peace. We're fighting for democracy. You know, those sentences do not make sense, and yet we keep making them. I do feel that I am a pioneer in making a peace language.
Thich Nhat Hanh does this, of course.
Oh, gosh, yeah. He does. What interesting phrases he writes. Peace is every step. That every word in that sentence is new, a new way of saying something.
When I think about phrases like fighting for democracy, though, and the rhetoric that's behind them, you had a lot of this start out with your opposition to the Persian Gulf War, and you've been, involved in peace marches against the war in Iraq and so forth. But there are, one wonders about different kinds of wars. For example, there were many who felt, despite the bombing and the terrible killing that went on, that Afghanistan was one of those maybe more necessary wars because we had been attacked on September 11th and because the Taliban were in Afghanistan. I mean, is there a distinction that needs to be made for the things that have to be fought for or fought against as opposed to those wars which really are not necessary?
You know, when we think about Bosnia, the former Yugoslavia, the siege of Sarajevo, and then there was Rwanda. There are horrible situations, and our first impulse is, oh, we've got to come to the rescue, and what can we possibly do? It's but to bring in army and airplanes and bombs.
Military to help the slaughter
and to
the
help
carnage.
It.
Yeah.
Yes. And I know that that is our first primitive, what would you call it, humanitarian impulse.
It's a good impulse, isn't it?
Yes. And yet, when we stop to think for a moment, is there anything that a that military equipment and war, is there anything that we make better by using bombs? I mean, it is a shortcut, but in the long run, do we really help? I love the that other impulse that came during the Afghanistan time. People were saying, bomb them with butter, bomb them with bread, bomb them with cell phones and blankets. And yeah, why not? You know, it sounded so frivolous. People were saying it. They were saying it seriously, but also frivolously. But we didn't even try it. Well, why not try it?
So in the short term, though, we may have gotten rid of the Taliban. You're mm-hmm. saying the problems are going to be festering and they're going mm-hmm. to be long-term.
But look at it right now. I just read that that during Saddam Hussein's time, there were hungry children, homeless children, but right now there are more. There are more hungry children and homeless children.
Talking with Maxine Hong Kingston, her most recent book is The Fifth Book of Peace. National Book Award-winning writer with us this morning for this second hour of Forum. I was reading something where you were being interviewed and you said, "I cry now more for public than for personal events as I age."
That is so strange. I surprise
That's
myself.
That's true. Yeah, you do? You surprise yourself because you cry more?
Yeah,
public?
Yeah, yeah. I really surprise myself yeah. because it seems to be a change in me since I went into my 60s. I'm not the crybaby anymore for personal losses. I just... But when I read the newspaper and I find a soldier killed or a child hurt or when I when I read about death camps from 50 years ago or the torture that
Abu Ghraib
the prison torture, and I surprise myself that can make me cry.
You take it in on some deeper level, obviously, perhaps than you did before. If it gets you that way and didn't before,
yeah.
You absorb it.
It
more.
Feels personal.
Yeah.
Although I don't think of it as personal.
Political is personal.
I think this is public.
You also, and I want to get to some of your work with veterans and so forth, but you also said, you should only do things that make you happy and you will create a peaceful world. How does doing things that make you happy create peace? In the connection there. For example, you now, you've been a gardener for a long time. You're doing more gardening now in your retirement, but it may create more inner tranquility, let's say. But the idea of peace beyond the self, where's the connection? Help me with that.
Maybe instead of talking about gardening, if I could talk about art or writing, what happens when I express my anger and my violence and my hatred, I mean, all these negative impulses which I have, if I could write about them, if I can make a story in which I can set these emotions into words, there's already a transformation that takes place. Words are rational. They're also very beautiful. Words are can be sung. In words, I can communicate my anger, but I haven't hit somebody, and I haven't shot anyone. Oh, you would be amazed, Michael. I know you're thinking about me as a pacifist, but a lot of times...
No, I know. I know from being a reader of yours that you have a lot of anger in you. I know you've worked with veterans who have had a lot of anger and worked it out as an outlet in their writing. But I'm thinking, when I'm reading you talking about this, I'm thinking about something like Jack Abbott, who writes about all this anger, gets out of jail, and then is living still by the jail ethos and kills a young waiter.
Well, a lot of times I think about picking up a gun and shooting people, or shooting a whole lot of people, and but. I will draw that. I paint. I will also put it into words, and I will describe that hateful person, and I will describe the shooting, the cutting off of heads, and the more I write it, the more shapely and wonderful it becomes, a wonderful story, and then a transformation takes place in me. My feelings, my thinking change as the story culminates, and all kinds of resolution and understanding happens when one writes the story.
Is it because story writing and storytelling and talk story and narratives and painting make you happy in a way,
yes,
or give you release? But
right,
there are many people who can't find that release,
yes,
of course, so they need other outlets.
Yes, or they need to write more and write better. Abbott should have written better. His writing wasn't good enough.
Now, Mailer thought it was, but he was wrong.
Well, Mailer was wrong. Yeah. And then the other miracle that takes place is that when a reader picks up a great book, through reading there's transformation. And so this is how we can get changes into the real political world.
So tell me about the images that you put down on paper. I mean, I know about your storytelling, and we'll talk about more of your storytelling. In fact, you write about a pacifist. That was the fourth book of peace, or at least someone avoiding conscription. Character that people who've read Tripmaster Monkey may remember, of course, Whitman. But when you're drawing, what are you doing?
When I am drawing, I am. I can take the paint and throw it out there and express horror and bombing. There is this image that I get often in recurring dreams, and I am working at my computer, and on the computer I am writing the rational, beautiful words, but all of a sudden the computer crashes, and this happens in real life, and it is so wrong that Microsoft, and you know, when your computer crashes, they put a bomb there. You know, you see this little bomb with a fuse. And on some horrible level that has gotten to me in my dreams, where that bomb explodes, and this is my fear of the bombs going off in Iraq, the big bomb that could go off at any moment, and it goes off. And my mind is very clear, and it's saying, there it is, and I'm dying, I'm dead. And all of a sudden, there's this big light, and then there's nothing, and I'm dead. And there's the last moment, things that go through my mind about saying goodbye to all my loved people, and goodbye to existence. But then, the next thing that happens, wait a minute, I'm still thinking. There's still
consciousness.
I'm still alive. I'm still conscious. Maybe this is a dream and it's not going to happen, and I'm not predicting the future.
we hope.
Yeah.
Talking to Maxine Hong Kingston. And when the fire took place in your home in the Oakland Hills, you couldn't write fiction for quite a while. I mean, you couldn't find the words.
Hmm? Mm-hmm. I could not write fiction because in fiction, we care about others. We care about a world, even a world that we made up and people whom we invent. I think fiction is it's a compassionate form where the writer is selflessly writing about others. I lost that after the fire, and I only used my ability and my talents to write about myself. And I would crawl into a corner and just whimper in my writing. And it did not make sense, and it didn't matter. I wrote the way I wrote when I was a child. It did not have to be grammatical or beautiful, and it was not for other people to read, and it was not for publication. And I was able to do that for a number of years before fiction could come back to me.
Well, the vets helped you, working with the vets, didn't they?
Yes.
Yeah. And getting them to do writing and getting them to open mm-hmm. up. The things that you, I mean, so many things that you remarked upon and wrote about with respect to this working with vets and establishing, I guess, some kind of sangha with the vets or community. And it's very elevating and moving to read. But their willingness to forgive, for example, the enemy, the Vietnamese enemy, but not the war protesters. I was just thinking about this because I was seeing Jane Fonda, you know, who's got this memoir and who's trying to say, I did a terrible thing, and you know, sitting on the aircraft and so forth. Please forgive me. And
there is she saying, please
she is saying
forgive
that,
me?
Yes. Said it was the worst thing I did in my life, and she's having all this remorse and contrition about it that I think is real. It's palpable. So she said, I'll take it to the grave. But there are some who will never forgive her.
But there are veterans who are beginning to forgive her. I was up in Alaska, and I met with some Buddhists who included a veteran of the Vietnam War, and he's getting ready to celebrate the 30 years of peace, he's calling it. And it's so positive. I mean, before they would say, 20 years anniversary of the fall of Saigon. I mean, that was the way they put it 10 years ago. But he's saying a celebration of 30 years of peace between our two countries. And he has sent out an invitation for veterans to come, and they would get on this fishing boat, and they would go out and fish for halibut and everything, and this would be their celebration. And he has sent out an invitation to Robert McNamara and to Jane Fonda.
Together at last.
Yes. So she should know about this.
She will. She's going to be on the program. I'll mention it to her, make a point of mentioning it to her. And if those of you listening would like the opportunity to speak with Maxine Hong Kingston, certainly one of our finest living writers, you are welcome to join us and do so now. And our toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786. We welcome them. You can join us from wherever you're listening to us or however, on the radio, the internet, or the Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. Her new book is The Fifth Book of Peace. You can also email us any questions or comments you might have. Email address here is forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we're talking this hour with Maxine Hong Kingston. Your calls are welcome. In fact, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. Her most recent book is The Fifth Book of Peace, and let's go to your calls, and let's begin with Alan. Hi, Alan.
Hi, how are you?
Good morning.
Good morning. I was wondering, in any of your research in looking at War and Peace, there's some apparently some new studies that have come out which are looking at the tie between a higher percentage of men in a population and propensity for war. I was wondering if you've come across any of that.
Oh, that's very interesting. In fact, I have come across a some very interesting stories. I just met a family that traveled through China extensively, and they told me that they came upon a village in which the roles were very different, and there was the women did a lot of the public task, and it took over the responsibility for running things, and the men they could relax, and the men would spend their time. Well, what she said was that the men spent their time teaching the parrots to talk, and it sounded like a very pleasant society, and the people were living happily.
Have you seen the Parrots of Telegraph Hill?
Yes.
Have you seen it? Yeah,
no, I haven't, but I've heard of it.
But the main character is just a very peaceful man. I mean, he strikes you right away as being kind of serene and tranquil.
Yeah. There have been lots of stories about the societies which are more matriarchal, or even chimpanzees which have a matriarchy. There are apes that have a matriarchal society, and they do tend to be less warlike.
The chimps can be very violent.
Yeah. But there's a chimp that they're called bonobos or
bonobos,
something like that.
Bonobos.
Yes, yes.
We did a program on it.
Yeah, and they seem to be peaceful.
Yeah, they are, for the most part. Anyway, let me thank the caller for that. You're doing an anthology with some of the veterans that you've been working with.
Yes. We're pulling everything together, and everybody is at the stage where they need to rewrite. And since the veterans have been meeting together for so long, I would like to have an anthology in which there is a story that they wrote 10 years ago, and then a new story that they are writing right now in the midst of this war in Iraq and war in Afghanistan. And so if we could publish everybody's stories side by side, we can see how their thinking has changed.
To mention the Parrots of Telegraph Hill, have you seen any of these very stylized and beautiful movies out of China about martial arts? I mean, there's this...
Yeah.
I mean, they're beautiful films, some of them, and very compelling in many ways. I mean, as stories, as plot lines. But, of course, they do, in a sense, glorify war and the martial arts and combat and all of those kinds of things.
Yes, and they also have the women fighting martial arts.
Women warriors. Yeah.
But I wonder whether if we can just think about martial arts truly, you know, there is the another aspect where one gives in or does the to let the opponent waste his energy with forceful fighting, and the other part of the Tai Chi movement, the Kung Fu movement, is to allow whatever happens, and go soft and move backwards, and
it's in most martial arts, actually.
Yes.
Certainly in karate, all forms of karate too.
Yes,
that sense of letting the other aggression of the opponent just
expend itself.
Exactly, expend itself.
Yeah.
We go next to Anne. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hello. Michael, and Maxine, I wanted to ask you a question. I know, Michael, you met Robert Mueller at the 50th anniversary of the UN celebration here in San Francisco. At least I think you were there when he was there. And Maxine, I heard you last year at the Literary Women's Program here in Contra Costa. And I wanted to ask you, Robert Mueller is one of my particular heroes, as he's the he was the former Undersecretary General of the UN. And he was beginning a peace college in Costa Rica. And I wondered if either of you knew anything about it and whether it was proceeding.
I don't know about that the Costa Rica Peace College, but I have heard that there are something like 300, I think the number is 300, it might even be 500 peace programs in the United States. And I have visited some of them, just incredible work in which methods of peace are explored. There are tactics and techniques and a study of the history of how peace is made, how negotiations are made, there are exercises and practices in which the students will be in groups where they learn to diffuse violence. In Hawaii, there is a high school, a Buddhist peace high school that has just started. And so this is a movement which is growing. And now there's even talk of how about a cabinet position, not just a minister of defense, but how about a cabinet member, a cabinet position where one could be a minister of peace.
Thank you for that call. I'm looking at an email here. It says, as one of the veterans in Maxine's group, I would like to thank her for her great work in righting a great cultural wrong. In the peace movement of the 60s and early 70s, many in the culture came to blame the Vietnam War on the soldiers themselves, as if the 18-year-old conscripts were making policy for the country. The soldiers were betrayed twice, once by the government that sent them blindly into a cultural conflict that our leaders did not understand at all, and once by those who viewed the war as the soldiers' fault. The depth of wound can be guessed at by the many veterans living on the street today. Maxine provided vets a place to heal and to transform their pain into art and their art into peace. And speaking about peaceful art...
Oh, what's her name? Is her name? I mean, let me see. Who is this? Let me see.
Wait, I'm going to read another email while
it's Joe Lam. Oh, you know, Joe Lam is an incredible person. He is he's an arborist, and he is the head of the Borneo project, in which the people go to Borneo and they reforest and
plant more trees.
Yes.
I've been active in Swords to Plowshares, and you know they're fundraising and emceeing events for them and so forth. And the thing that you discover about many of these Vietnam veterans is just exactly what he said, that sense that they, you know, some of them were almost spit upon, and some of them were literally called baby killers and all this sort of thing because of the Lieutenant Cali horror and massacre, which set many people's teeth on edge, understandably. But the blame of, as he said, 18-year-old conscripts is just unconscionable. And so many of these people continue to suffer on the streets. The thing I love about Swords to Plowshares is they work on getting people like that to use some of their anger, as I think you do, in more constructive ways to help get them out of substance abuse, to help make them do things that are socially useful and socially as well as personally useful to reconstruct themselves. This is another email from one of our listeners who writes, I'm so pleased to be hearing your present guest. As a Chinese-American, a postmodern writer, and a pacifist, Miss Aung Kingston has long been an inspiration and a powerful influence upon my life and work. I had the great pleasure in the past of studying under her colleague James Houston at UC Santa Cruz. In my own personal pantheon of saints, she's right up there with Dr. King and Jason Webley, and I'm not just saying this as a buttering up preface to my question for her. I'm wondering if she might have any tips for finding an agent for an unpublished manuscript.
Oh, gosh.
I just had to read that. I'm sorry. If you want that kind of advice, you're going to have to contact Maxine personally. Let me go to the next caller. Marge, good morning.
Margo,
I'm sorry. Yes, hi.
Yes, I am very excited to be talking with you, first of all, because I think you do a wonderful job. I just recently moved back to the Bay Area. I've lived in a lot of different places, and I'm just thrilled, Maxine, to hear the use of storytelling and peacemaking work. I'm going to be attending the Summer Peacebuilding Institute, which is part of Eastern Mennonite University's program. They have a something called Transformative. It's a master's program in transformative mediation, and there's a marvelous woman that's going to be doing a 10-day intensive on the use of theater ritual in peacemaking. And that's what she did her dissertation on as well.
Well, remember when Susan Sontag went to Bosnia with Waiting for Godot?
Yes, 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 yes. And, yeah, the theater is, well, as Antonin Artaud told us, it's ritual also. Theater is almost church. I mean, for me, it's the Greeks use theater as church, and there you have people whose bodies move in such a way, and then when they so that they can change the body, and then the Greeks felt that when you were watching theater, then your emotions that there is pity and terror. And
a catharsis.
Yes. And that transforms the emotions, transforms the body. And, you know, we talk about the theater of war. You don't have to go to war to get some pity and terror. I mean, just go to the theater, make some good theater.
Well, you talk about the Greeks, and Margot, thank you for your call. There's a book by Francis Ferguson called Theater as Ritual, where he writes about how maybe in a play like Oedipus Rex by Sophocles, there would be a kind of exorcism of violence that the Greeks who attended that particular dramatic production felt in Oedipus' blinding himself and so forth, a release of emotion, a catharsis again of pity and terror, and as a result, perhaps would be more pacific in their dealings with others. In other words, it was a kind of an exorcism almost of aggression. I think there's a lot to be said for that, isn't there?
The one part of Greek thinking that I worked on as I was working on the Fifth Book of Peace, I kept remembering Aristotle's advice. How do we make drama? Drama has to have conflict and action. And I don't know whether he said it, but I read into it that drama has to have violence, combat. And maybe the reason I read that into it is I go to movies, I watch television, and in our culture, drama is made with violence. And so I kept asking myself, is it possible to tell a peace story? And it has excitement, it has drama, but do I have to have killing and shooting and fighting at the climactic moment? And so in the Fifth Book of Peace, I kept working for drama, which would be like human emotion, real communication, which would be, you know, sometimes I think the reason that we hit each other is we're trying to communicate. Now listen to me, and if you're not listening, I'm going to punch you so that you can feel the emotions which I am trying to convey to you. But what if I could write a story that in which everyone communicates so well that we are communicating happy feelings, great feelings, compassion, and we can feel pity and mercy and goodness for one another.
It's a wonderful ideal. It wouldn't get as much attention in the American way of things, don't you think?
You know, I think the Fifth Book of Peace is getting its attention. It's not getting as much attention as, you know, movies in which there's a lot of combat.
It's getting attention because you're the author, too. I mean, it has a good deal to do with it. But and this is not to stroke you, as that other emailer said. But there's something very elemental about what you're trying to put across. In fact, I was struck by just the architecture of your book where you talk about fire, paper, earth, and water. I mean, as if, notwithstanding paper, we're talking about really elemental.
I know. I wanted to talk about, I wanted paper to be an elemental object. Well, it is an element. It's wood. In the Chinese cosmology, wood is an element.
We're going to go to some more calls. And by the way, if you'd like to join us with Maxine Hong Kingston, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or you can join us by email at forum. That is, the email address is forum@kqed.org. Jesse, good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I'm calling from Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to appreciate Maxine and yourself for raising these issues. I guess I have two questions. I've been homeless. I'm not currently, but I have been. And there's kind of an ironic thing, and that is that if you're incarcerated, you get a great deal more. There's people teaching yoga and music to people who are doing time. But when you find yourself homeless, the kind of work that Maxine has done with veterans, they really don't provide it for homeless or even poor people. And I guess underneath that, I wanted to raise, to ask Maxine about class issues and how can we use the tools she's talking about with, say, for example, Oakland, where there's a great deal of racial polarization, and, you know, for homeless people. And the other question I'll ask, and then I'll take my answer off the air, is does she think that the perspective of veterans, how the world views veterans, has changed since Vietnam, since people have kind of realized that it wasn't the veterans' fault? So I'll take the answers off the air, and I want to appreciate you again.
Thank you, and thank you for the call. First of all, outreaching to homeless and poor on the kinds of issues that concern you, I think...
You know, yesterday I was with James Houston and Gene Wakasuki Houston, in fact, in Salinas. And we were in this all-night read-in to prevent the closing of the Salinas libraries. All three of them in Salinas are closing from lack of funds, and which I know those funds are going into this war, $1.3 trillion for future wars, and nothing for the Salinas public libraries. And the libraries are a center of culture. Those are free libraries. When I was a kid, the homeless of Stockton, that's where the homeless go for their culture, for their warmth, for the warmth that they...
for the restrooms.
Yes, for the restrooms. And there is a place where they can go. And that was where I went when I wasn't homeless, but I was a kid who I was one of the latchkey kids, and the library was where you can go, and it's a safe place, and there's people who can watch over you, and in libraries there are programs where people can take it. Children. I mean, the programs are set up for children, where the children can listen to stories, where the children can do their homework and make art and read. The homeless try to make it their home too, because they can hang out and read the newspapers, and they sleep under the newspapers. But these places are they are closing, and so the question remains: what do we do for people who are left out? And a lot of those homeless are veterans of a lot of them, the veterans of Vietnam War.
And of course, it's not only the libraries; it's the social programs and the drug substance abuse programs and employment help programs and so forth and so on that are also closing down that have helped these people in the past. Caller also mentioned, do you think that there's been sort of a lessening of rancor toward Vietnam veterans? I think there has, don't you?
I think there is a dangerous lessening of rancor for soldiers. When we are saying support the troops, and we have those yellow ribbons all over the place, support the troops, what we're asking is, no matter what the circumstances, no matter whether we're right or wrong, let's not, we're saying, okay, we made a mistake spitting on them before. We're holding them responsible for our nation's foreign policy and for our government's mistakes. And what we're saying now is, let's just mindlessly support them no matter what. We're taking advantage of the, yes, we do want to support every single man and woman, every 18-year-old that's out there. But that doesn't mean that I support my government's policies.
So when you have these flights of imagination and think about shooting people, are they mainly people who are making policy in government?
No, no, yeah, no.
They're not necessarily political figures, then. They're
no, you know what? To be honest, I think about shooting myself. You know, when something goes, I'm one of those people who takes it internally, and so when I feel upset at other people, I think about shooting myself.
So the writing is a good outlet of against the aggression that you would use against yourself.
Yeah, yeah. But you know what it means is what goes around comes around. All these chickens come home to roost, all these things, you know. I guess I have a very hard time blaming others. It's my responsibility. Everything George Bush does, it's my responsibility, and I've got to do something about it.
Let me take another call, and this is from Mark. Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
I have a question for Maxine, and that is, whereas I would consider myself a pacifist for the most part, I do, you know, admire the teachings of Gandhi and Martin Luther King, but I'm always struck by a question that one woman in the movie of Gandhi asked him, and as the son of a Holocaust survivor myself, I'm always struggling with this question of, you know, how do you stop a totalitarian regime or a person like Hitler without violence?
It's a very basic question, Maxine. Some thoughts? How do you fight evil when evil is going to use violence against you, or that kind of notion?
I have a feeling that, you know what happens when there is an emergency. Hitler starts, you know, he starts his chaos, or some emergency happens. Then right away, pacifists are asked the question, how can you solve it using Gandhian principles? And pacifists are brought in like as if we were the fire department, you know. But pacifist principles take a long time. That's what's so frustrating. We need so much time, whereas a bomb and a bullet just takes a moment. And so the work of a pacifist has to be constant. We work in the long term. And we work the way preventive medicine works. You know, you just don't go to the doctor when you're sick. You do the you live healthfully. You constantly work on being peaceful and kind and generous and giving with every single person who crosses your path, with every situation that you have an opportunity to work with. And
it's a real higher and lifetime calling. I understand what you're
saying. It's a lifetime calling. And if there were a lot of people working like this, let's say in 1900 or 1914, then maybe Hitler would not have appeared in 1935.
But he did, and a whole nation got swept up in his fervor,
yes.
And they started taking people away to gas chambers and to furnaces and so forth. And
but if everyone had been working that, then the German country would not have been the way they were. They would not have elected Hitler in the first place. You know, it is hard because what we do as pacifists is a lifetime project, and maybe we are ending wars 10 years from now, 100 years from now. Some war is not happening because of our actions today.
But you were talking before about yin and yang. There's your actions, as admirable as they are, with pacifism, would be certainly viewed by many as being perhaps a kind of hopeless idealism, because there's always that other, that yang, you know, that push forward to take people to gas chambers, or to do what Pol Pot did, or to do what was done in Rwanda. And so it keeps occurring all over the world.
Well, the Buddhists would say that there is there's non-duality. It's not as if here's yin and there's yang, there's good and there's evil. All of it is intricately mixed.
I think we have another minute here, though we heard the music there. Yeah, getting my blood pressure going way, way up. I understand what you're saying. And actually, here's a read from Oakland, who writes, "You know, the martial arts which allow the opponent to defeat him or herself with the strength of his or her aggression are reflected in and probably affected by the philosophy of Sun Tzu himself," which I think is right.
But Sun Tzu also was working for peace.
Well, you're certainly doing the same. And let me congratulate you on your work, not only on behalf of peace and with veterans, but also this new book, which I hope people will read, The Fifth Book of Peace. Always a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
Maxine Hong Kingston, we'll be back on tomorrow. We'll be talking about Hetch Hetchy in the opening hour, and then an hour on the sounds of slavery. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. Our producers are Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Engineer is Howard Gelman, and executive producer Raul Ramirez. And I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.